What up, y'all, and welcome to episode number 3 of In the Bush podcast. You guys, this episode was so fun with James. We dove deep in several different subjects, and James is such a great guy. He's a rancher, he's a father, he's a Marine, he's an outfitter, he's a podcaster. I mean, this dude couldn't pack anything more to do into his schedule. Being all those things and still getting out there and getting to have some adventures of his own. We had such a great conversation with James, and I really think y'all are going to like this episode. But first, I want to let you know this episode is brought to you by BushSurvivalTraining.com. If you guys want to brush up on your skills and you want to get into some of those survival training methods and the different practices that we have and the woodsmanship and just all those things, go to BushSurvivalTraining.com. Check out the courses that are online. Joel has a $25 online course. You can go there. And if you want to reach out to me for some private consultation, I do some Zoom work and some online classes at LearnHuntHarvest.com. Okay, you can go to those and you can leave us some, or send us an email there if you want, get in contact with us there. You can also reach us on our Instagrams. This is a great way to get in contact with us and also leave some subjects or leave some questions. My Instagram is Cole Wilkes Hunter. Joel's Instagram is Joel V Bushcraft. You guys go check us out there. And if you haven't hit the follow button yet on this podcast, what are you doing? Hit the follow button, you guys, and also try and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us out. We're trying to grow this podcast. Then do us a favor. Share it with your friends. Tell people about it. Help us out. We so appreciate it. And I don't want to delay any longer. So let's get to the podcast.
Adami zetu akwete mayanda hamea sanza tina kwa tani tasi kwa tabema ukuwa maukwa ishi.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to In the Bush podcast with Cole and Joel. James, I want to thank you so much for coming on. And it's so funny, dude, because Joel and I are really good friends, and we came about this whole podcast and everything. And he told me that he was friends with you. And I was geeking out because I followed you on Instagram to begin with. So I knew quite a bit about you. And then lo and behold, you are somebody that Joel's been kind of confining into with hunting, you know, trying to get hunting knowledge of areas and just, you know, hunting practices in general. So I was super excited. And we want to welcome you to the podcast, and I want to give you a second to kind of introduce yourself and tell us who James Nash is in a nutshell.
Well, thank you both for hosting. And yeah, Joel's been great, man. Joel's helped me out a lot too, and I always enjoy talking with him. I grew up here on the Sixth Ranch in Northeast Oregon, in the northeast corner of the state. And the ranch is between the Eagle Cap Wilderness and Hell's Canyon. So the Eagle Caps are Oregon's largest wilderness area and have, I think, 17 of the state's 20 highest peaks, something like that. And then Hell's Canyon is the deepest canyon in North America. And that's the country that I grew up in, cowboying and guiding. I started guiding when I was 14 years old. I've continued guiding periodically or more or less constantly since then. Although there's times like, you know, I spent 5 years in the Marine Corps. Obviously, I wasn't doing a lot of guiding during those times. I spent a year in Norway when I was in high school, which was a really formative and interesting experience. I went to college in Montana. I studied literature and writing. I went into the Marine Corps after that. I fought fire for many years. I was on a helicopter rappel crew and fought wilderness fires in really remote areas. So much of my life has been doing hard work in hard places, and the shape of that work has changed, whether that's guiding or cowboying or fighting fire or fighting wars. It's all been hard and in austere environments. And I find myself attracted to those places and those types of things, and am constantly looking for the next opportunity to slip into something like that. Although I don't do it to the extent that, say, Joel does. You know, I bring some technologies and some creature comforts with me, and I leverage technology a lot. I'm a huge fan of it. But I do it in a way that gets me into a place where I can satiate my desire to have these adventures.
Thank you, James. That's filled in a couple of blanks for me, but there were specific questions I had, which you've kind of answered, but I kind of want to jump off a couple of them. First and foremost, the ranch, how many generations has that ranch been in the family?
We are six generations deep right now. The ranch was founded in 1884 and is one of the oldest businesses in the state of Oregon.
Wow.
Wow.
Something you must be immensely proud of.
I am proud of it. It's a tremendous opportunity, but also a generational burden as well. Like I have a genetic obligation to keep this going. And while I love it, it's oftentimes very hard. Hard in ways that aren't always satisfying. And that's the nature of agriculture and the nature of ranching. The average age of a rancher in the U.S. today is 56 and a half years old. Farmers and ranchers make up 2% of our population. We're coming up against some hard times for food production. And I think that should be a warning to a lot of people to start developing their self-sufficiency, and whether that takes form of hunting or learning how to harvest and gather or grow their own crops, it's something that people need to start thinking about.
Absolutely. I think it's crucial. And just to jump kind of to keep on topic, but sort of off topic a little bit. One of the things, I'm a U.S. citizen. I've been a U.S. citizen for, I think, a couple years. Lived here, obviously, a lot more longer than that. And I'm really proud of it. I'm proud to be in a country that has this public land system. And I first and foremost wanted to say that this public land system, I think, is maybe taken for granted by a lot of people. There are very, very few countries in the world. I've been to a lot of countries. There are very few that have a public land system like this, where we have this unbelievable opportunity to walk out into the woods. Obviously, you have to do it within regulation. You got to get licenses, there's seasons and everything like that. But you can walk off into the woods and hunt your own meat. There's a lot of countries that don't have that ability. Very regulated, or there's just not enough game. It's all been hunted out. I feel like this should be an opportunity that should be taken advantage of by many. Granted, it's not easy, but to sort of agree with you, I agree that self-sufficiency, I mean, we're living on a continent that still provides resources for us to do this. Obviously, these resources have to be managed, and this is a topic I'd love to chat to you about more later, but still, we have an abundance of game that we can hunt here almost year-round. If you kind of jump between different types of game, you can hunt almost year-round and feed yourself well from it. And yet, it isn't celebrated outside of the community. I feel like it's shunned or disrespected by a lot of people because they look at it and think that hunters are, I mean, quote unquote, you know, killing the wildlife. You know, this is something that is obviously controversial. And, you know, I did want to say this is a topic which I know is very, very close to your heart. I have listened to many podcasts of yours. I follow you on social media, and I love the fact that you are not only vocal about this, but you are extremely knowledgeable. You know what you're talking about. And voices like yours, which are sort of unashamedly putting this knowledge across, because it is what it is. You tell it how it is and like it is. And that is something that needs to be heard. It does need to be tactfully done. But in a world where we're going to, where we want to be self-sufficient and we want to feed ourselves off of the land, we have to all understand that there's going to be death for that to happen. Just like a cow has to die and get taken to market and we buy it from the market. Well, we're just taking the life out of our own, well, we're putting it in our own hands, right? We're putting in all the hard work to go and take that life, but a life is going to be lost. But the things that I feel very passionate about, and I know you do too, are that I absolutely agree with you that we do need to focus more on self-sufficiency. I mean, the direction that we're all headed is questionable, and resources are limited, but we do have these resources that are managed out in this public land that are there for the taken. And I love, first of all, I was looking for the opportunity to say thank you. And so here's my opportunity. Thank you for what you do for the hunting community. And you do it in a way that I do think is tactful. And you've completely opened up my eyes. And I can only hope and pray that the average, just the general public, will be, have the opportunity to receive information like you put out.
Thank you very much. I don't have much of an agenda in doing it. And I think that that helps, right? Like, I'm just trying to be honest, and I get stuff wrong all the time. And one of the really beautiful things about it, I was recently talking with somebody who's really smart about this stuff. And he said, the type of media that you're producing is scientific in a lot of ways. It's just not peer reviewed. And I said, oh no, there are 300,000 people that are peer reviewing me every time I push anything out there.
Absolutely. So,
In a lot of ways, it gets reviewed on a higher level than anything else that you could possibly do, because it is outside of an echo chamber, and the chamber is tremendous, right? So there's lots of people that are right there to correct me when I'm wrong, and what a tremendous opportunity for me to be able to learn that quickly and make those corrections and accept those corrections with some humility and then build from it. We live in such a beautiful age of information and opportunity, and the opportunities to go out and take that information and then test it and experiment with it and get experiences in these wild places, that's there for everybody. It's close by. We have so many millions of acres of public land that's available, and also huge amounts of private land that are accessible through different programs or just through permissions. Like, there's just tremendous opportunity for people to get outside and enjoy it and suffer in it and come out of it being a better or at least more tempered person at the end of their experience.
I got to ask, jumping back to the guiding thing for a second.
Yeah.
I've guided spearfishing charters. I've guided outdoor recreational type stuff, survival stuff, but I've never guided hunting. I would love to know over the years, so since 14 years old, so you've got what, 20 plus years of guiding experience at this point?
Yeah, 24 years.
That is a long time. How has that changed your outlook? There's two questions. How has it changed your sort of outlook on hunting in general, and how has it improved? How has it improved you as a person and as a hunter?
I don't know if it has improved me as a person. It actually might have made me worse. A lot of guiding is just social interactions in an outdoor environment, and it's customer service work at the end of the day. And just like a lot of, you know, waitresses might get jaded towards customers, so do guides. And people are sometimes horrified to listen in on conversations that occur guide to guide at trade shows and stuff. And we love most of our clients very much, but there's a few that we really don't, you know, not everybody's a good person. And yeah. Sometimes I have a lot of guilt about what I'm doing. And when we wound bull elk, for example, I guide a lot of archery elk. And the reality of that is that 50%, maybe 70% of those animals, you don't find them. Archery is horribly ineffective at killing elk. And I have to think about, am I being complicit in something that I despise? Am I doing it for money? Mm. Am I enabling somebody to go out and wound an elk who otherwise couldn't get within a mile of it, or maybe even in the same zip code? And because of what I'm doing, now that animal is going to go die slowly, you know? Mm. So there's aspects of it that are really hard on me emotionally, psychologically, but then there's other aspects of it that elevate me so much and give me drive to do things that are superhuman. You know, I guided every day of archery season this year. It's the first year I've ever guided every single day. So I was there a couple days before the season. I worked through the entire season. I averaged 20 hour days. All right.
Yeah.
That is an extreme, extreme output for anybody to do at any job. Yeah. And if I didn't have such passion for what I'm doing, it would be physically impossible. Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So yeah. In some ways I'm elevated in what I can do, and otherwise I'm very much dragged down. And at the end of hunting season, I feel pretty old anymore.
Yeah.
You're constantly evolving with all this stuff, I guess is what I'm saying. And there's not just highs and lows, because that makes it look like a cardiac heart rhythm thing. it's so much more asymmetrical than that. The way that you evolve and feel about yourself and develop skills and lose skills. But at the core, you develop some really interesting relationships with people. And when you have a person that you're helping hunt and they find success the way they've defined it, and you go out and do that together, out in the woods and the canyons, there's just nothing like it. It's a very unusual job. It's almost like being a matchmaker in some ways. It's like, hey, I'd like to introduce you to this elk. If you like what you're looking at, you can go ahead and kill him. You know, it's odd.
Yeah,
it's a strange thing. But it's also so much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
How do you manage the expectation?
Expectation management is something that you learn after you've guided for 5 to 10 years. At least that was the case for me. So now I have those conversations as early as possible. And I used to give people the trip that I thought that I would want. And that's a really novice approach to guiding. So what I do now is I say, how would you define success on this hunt or this fishing trip or this river expedition, whatever we're doing? And people tell me it's like cheating on the test. And then if their expectation of a desired result is something that's impossible, I can crush that right then, rather than find out at the end of the trip that they wanted something that didn't exist.
Mm.
That's so huge. So I want to bounce back really quick, because I thought about this actually today. We were talking about the elk hunter. Okay. Elk hunting is something that is near and dear to my heart. I'm an Elk Bros coach for the Elk Bros podcast. And Joel and I have spent a lot of time in the elk woods. Okay. I think there's a lot of guys out there that are lying to themselves and wanting to go out and get the job done that are not prepared to go get the job done in an elk hunt. And they're making it, and I hate to, man, this is, we can go down a rabbit hole here, but like the opportunities of over the counter and stuff like that are going down the hill so fast, and the amount of elk are not changing how many are killing. It's because the amount of people that are coming and that are not being successful, right? It's these guys that are flooding into the woods and going about all this whole hunt, I think sometimes maybe in a wrong way, or they're not quite ready, right? And I'm talking about like the OTC guy. you probably see it in guiding as well, James, to where these guys have these huge expectations and then they come up there and people don't understand the amount of physical ability you have to have just to hike in backcountry and carry your camp on your back if you want to go do that style, right? How many guys do you see that show up at camp that if you don't have a horse or something there for them to ride, they're not going to get to camp?
Like zero. So I think that the physical aspect of getting to the elk is one of the most over-exaggerated things in all of hunting. And if you walk around these trade shows, you're going to see 10 different companies that are selling various forms of Kool-Aid that they're trying to tell people will help them kill elk. It's the craziest thing in the world. There's entire fitness industries that are built around it. And getting to the elk, that's easy. That's so easy. I took a gentleman out a few years ago who had lost both arms and one leg in an IED blast, and he got a 6-point bull elk. All right. He had very little physical ability to move his body around, but all we had to do was go slow. And that's the harder thing to do for most people. And the better shape that they're in, the harder it is for them to go slow. There are some old guys who are absolute assassins out there, and they're, you know, basically at the stage where they need to use a walker to move around in the woods. That's deadly. Now, getting back out of the backcountry, that is largely understated, okay? And very much so by people who are really famous and really popular. So I'm a big data guy. I try to have numbers to back up the things that I say, and I get to weigh most of the elk that we shoot during archery season. I get them out whole and I get to weigh them. So average live weights are between 700 and 800 pounds on a bull elk. Earlier in the season, like end of August, that's when you're going to get your 800 pounders. The heaviest one I've ever weighed was 812 pounds, and he was huge, huge bull.
That's a big bull.
Okay. It's a big bull. Now, once I get them head knocked off, skinned, and gutted, the difference between a 4-year-old bull and an 8 or 9-year-old bull might only be 10 or 20 pounds of difference. Okay. So their muscle and bone structure is basically the same from age 4 all the way on.
Interesting.
Now, if I take that 750-pound bull and I get him completely boned out, and I take rib meat, I take neck meat, I take everything that I can off that animal that's edible and hang it in bags. We did this year. It weighed 230 pounds. So what are you carrying on your back, and what percentage of your capability is that? You know, I hunt with about 32 pounds, somewhere in there, 28 to 32 pounds, depending on how much water I've got with me. And I can walk all day like that. That's a pretty comfortable weight. When I start getting into the 40s or 50s, then that really takes away from my ability to maneuver in the woods and put on miles if I need to. So if I'm going to add 230 pounds to that, and I'm going to, you know, live out this imaginary scenario of a solo backcountry wilderness hunter, how many trips is that? And can I actually do that? And if you can't do it in practice, like if you can't throw, you know, 2 plates onto your pack on top of the gear that you're using just to live out there, and I'm talking about space as well as the actual weight, and then go do miles and see how much you can do that, even if it's on roads, see what you can do. Because let's say it's going to take 4 trips. That's about right for 230 pounds to not, you know, kill yourself and blow up Achilles tendons and things like that, which a lot of people carry heavy and they hurt themselves. So if you're going to do 4 trips and you're 4 miles back, how many miles is that going to end up being with heavy weight on? And can you actually do that? And 4 miles, that ain't nothing, right? So it's easy for us to walk a great distance back in there with our light camp and things like that. But then is it going to take 4 or 5 days during September to get all that meat out when it might be 90 degrees during the day, and you've got all kinds of critters back there, from the bugs to the bears, that are going to be tampering with that meat. The reality is, if you are by yourself and you are more than 4 miles back, it's almost impossible to get that meat out without wasting some of it.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I killed a bull in Lolo unit in Idaho. Joel and I hunted there 2 years ago, and I shot that bull at like 4:30 in the afternoon, and it was 94 degrees. And we, luckily the guy that shared camp with down there had horses that he came in that night and brought horses. And even then, that next morning when we got out, I didn't know it until I got all the meat home, but I did have some bone sour, and we were able to truck that sucker straight back to the truck, you know, with horses, and get him out that very next day. But a lot of people don't think about that, especially in early season. But I also think it weeds a lot of people out when they get that 35 to 45 pounds on their back and they get to hiking back there. They learn real fast when that shit gets steep and it starts to get hard. It eliminates a lot of the people that had the big wishes.
It does, but I also think that there's a lot of meat that goes to waste, because when they get put in that position, you think they're going to do that third or fourth trip? I think the average person probably wouldn't. They'd probably talk themselves out of it. Mm. And so that's unfortunate.
Or they start panicking and like trying to call around and you know, find friends all of a sudden, because they just didn't plan for this. They don't understand it. I saw somebody at the hardware store here several years ago during rifle cow season, and they were trying to find a game cart. This is a really rural area. We don't have much in the way of goods and services. All right. I've got to drive an hour to buy a pair of socks. All right. So they couldn't find a game cart for sale anywhere. Couldn't find anybody that had one. So they were at the hardware store buying a wheelbarrow. Yes, and that's how they were planning on trying to get out of Hell's Canyon. Like, good luck, Chuck. Good luck. Maybe you can ride it to the bottom and like thumb a trip out with a jet boat if you're lucky. But dude, you're just, people are really, really unprepared. And a lot of it is because they've been lied to, man. They've been lied to by people who really romanticize this style of hunting. And it's relatively ineffective, for one. If your goal is to kill an animal and bring the meat home, it's relatively ineffective from that standpoint, just as a tactic. And then the reality of it hits them when they walk up to that bull or cow or whatever. They're like, oh, geez, these things are big, yeah. You know? So I don't think
any of us are here to like jump on the bandwagon of like all these idiots don't know what they do. You know,
No, that's
we're
not.
Just coming from the point of view that there's a lot to this, right? There's a lot to this, and it takes. I think back to your point, Cole. You were saying how certain people just aren't ready.
Just be honest with yourself, like. I get you have the vacation time or whatever to go this year, but are you ready? What's your tactic? Are you going to spot and stalk? Like we could dive in so deep into this, but I wanted to make a point to some people that like, if you're not ready, guys, don't go out there and go fill these spaces full of people and then be pushing animals around or not be tactfully going in there or go with an outfitter, like with James, somebody that could almost kind of show you the ropes and cut that learning curve. I'm just talking, you know, I want to have the opportunity for people like me and you, Joel, and low budget folks to be able to go buy OTC tags and still be able to go hunt without all this stuff disappearing into a draw system and stuff like that. And I think it's because we're being overflown with people that have they have that bug to want to go do it, but they're not quite ready yet in whatever aspect. You know what I mean? Like it could be a many different things.
Well,
you know,
there's also the point of like, well, when are you ever ready? I mean, you know, like how do you know when you're ready and when you're not ready? Like, this conversation could go a lot of different ways, but I think that first and foremost, we have to put the animal first. That's the way I look at it, the animal first. If you don't feel like you can go out there and approach the hunt in a way that's going to be the most respectful way of doing it for that animal, and that goes hand in hand with understanding your abilities, then maybe you should hold off, you know?
So let's talk about what causes failures. Just for the folks that are like, how do I know? How do I know if I'm ready? This is what I'd say. If you can throw a 45-pound pack on your back and you can walk 4 miles in an hour, then you're physically ready to go do the hunting. For the actual packing out, you need to test that and see if you can carry 90 pounds for whatever distance, cumulative distance, you're going to be going. And cumulative meaning that look at it from a four-trip perspective. If you're going with a buddy and they have the same physical ability as you, then cut that in half. And that's a way of testing it preseason. But I can tell you, the failures that I see, I'm trying to generalize this. I would say 7 out of 10 are mental failures, and the other 3 are mechanical.
Mm.
So there's gear failures, and then there's failures in the mind.
Could you talk more specifically about the mental failures?
I'll talk about it all day. We talk about target panic. We talk about buck fever, bull fever, things like that. Here's what I think is going on. We get caught in the middle of polar tensions. And on one side, one of the things that's pulling on us is a desire for gain. Whatever that gain is that a picture? Is it an experience? Is it meat? Right? You want to achieve what you've set out to achieve. You've got this desire for gain. On the other side, you have a fear of failure or a fear of loss. And then caught in the middle is little old you just trying to do your job. And your job is a simple thing. I pulled 600 elk hunters a few years ago about the distances that they'd killed bulls at. And the average of those 600 guys and gals was 23 yards. That is not a hard shot. That's not. It's not physically hard to do that. It doesn't require a huge amount of skill to do that. You can practice up to that level really soon. But if you get caught in that tug of war and you are getting pulled stronger from one side or the other, then you're emotionally and spiritually off balance, and you're not going to be able to do that simple thing of making a 23-yard shot because you can't focus on your process anymore. And how you're talking to yourself during that shot and leading up to that shot has everything to do with how the shot actually gets executed. So if you say, you know what, Joel, you're a good shot. You've made shots like this all the time. This is an easy shot for you. You've practiced enough. You've got all the right gear. This thing is basically on the grill right now. You're going to smoke that bull, and he's going to go like 18 yards and throw up blood and die on the ground, never knowing what's happened. Okay. If you start thinking to yourself, all right, Joel, be careful. Don't let him see you. He might get away. What if the wind switches, things like that? You are going to miss. You're going to miss. You're going to wound. Something's going to go wrong. You're going to forget to put an arrow on your bow. Like, I've seen it all. Mm-hmm. And that is what it comes down to: fear of loss, desire for gain, lack of focus on the process, and how you're talking to yourself. Are you being positive and kind to yourself, or are you letting anxiety and doubt win the day?
Absolutely fantastic, James. Yeah, and I will say, to put myself out there and express my vulnerability, this is the biggest hurdle I am overcoming. Is what I've narrowed down to in the most simplest form is the inability to focus, to where you have this blank spot where you're just not able to focus. And that self-talk, like you say, I think is really the key, is to force yourself to focus. You need a tool. And that self-talk seems to be a really good tool. I did a session with Joel Turner a few years back, and you know, he helped immensely with that aspect. We're going to have him on the podcast here soon. But what he's preaching is just so important, because I know that the target panic just riddles so many guys, and guys who have decades of experience. It's like one of those things that just doesn't seem to go away. It's something you have to work at constantly. Would you agree that it's constant work to keep that in control?
it just depends how you're living. I guarantee you, I haven't shot my bow in a while. If I walked out here into my shop and grabbed my bow, I could put the target at any reasonable range and I'd shoot an X. And that's how I start every year. My first shots out of my bow are beautiful, man. It is just awesome. And I wish that people could watch me shoot for the first time of the year, because it is flawless. And then it gets progressively worse until about July. You know,
archery is so funny like that, man. It's always like that.
And then I start just like clawing my way back towards competency, praying that I've got it before season starts. But the reason is because I haven't had a bunch of failures recently, right? So everything that's been going on in my life right now has been going really well. I'm living great. Things are awesome right now. And I'm confident that since I've shot a bow for 33 years now, that I can go out and I can do the job just fine. But part of shooting a bow is that it's inherently inaccurate, because it's connected to a goofy human who's just a water balloon wrapped around some calcium. So as we shoot, naturally you're gonna have some bad shots, and if you don't analyze what caused that shot to go off and do so in a really I guess unsentimental way, then it starts to become emotional baggage that you bring to the next shot and the next shot and the next shot, and those failures drag you down, and then that side of the rope starts pulling on you harder, right? So I do think that it is a vampire bite to an extent, but also to the point that I was making earlier, if we know that the highest likelihood is that that shot is going to be 23 yards, why are we spending so much time working on shooting rather than on building up our mental resilience?
100%.
Great point.
Yeah. So, I mean, to speak to that, so what you're saying is the majority of the people is they fail whenever it comes time to execute. It's getting up to that point and everything, and getting their hiking in and doing all that. They've got it and they nail it up until the point that they really need to have it dialed in. And that's where people really fall apart, is right there at that very end. How do you freaking train that though, man? How do you train that for the average guy?
Couldn't be easier. You just focus on your process and say nice things to yourself and make that part of your process. If as you start to add tension to your string or to your trigger, you know, when you take your rifle off safety, whatever you're using, I don't care if you're using a crossbow. You know, I'd hunt with an Abrams M1A1 if they let me. All right. So if the thing that you do just as you're starting to execute that shot is say something nice to yourself, then you're going to improve. So just build that into your process and focus on that process. And that's how you get icy. And I hunt with people in my personal life, my friends, who are killers. They're killers. They're icy. And it's because they say nice things to themselves. They're confident in the outcome. They've done all the work that they need to do to be competent at whatever task they've put ahead of themselves. And they focus on the process. And I can tell you, you know, with 100% certainty that the times that I don't do well at something are the times that I'm feeling doubt as I'm starting to do it. And it's just a feeling. It's all make believe.
It's fear. It's just fear. Yeah,
that's fantastic. Huge.
I mean, this is something that I don't care if you hunt with if you hunt by throwing stones or using a machine gun. Like, this is real for each and every person, and you're going to have to overcome it in your own way to be confident, right? Because that's, I think, ultimately the message that I get, and I know that I've really taken a lot of this from Cole, is just the level of confidence. When I'm with hunters that are really just consistently successful and very experienced, there is a level of confidence that exudes out of them that I think is the key. And of course, that confidence is, I think, easier said than done as far as gaining it. I think there's a mixture of experience and then maybe just a mixture of your personality. But that is, I think, one of the key factors here is just being confident in your ability and in the hard work that you've put in.
And being honestly confident, right? There's all kinds of people who are confident in doing something that they haven't earned that confidence yet. And I've been guilty of that in the past and will be again. So understand your abilities, and you should have enough record of attempts to know what your abilities are, and then just be confident that you can do that again. What we're using, no matter what the weapon is, what we're using are mechanical things, right? Whether it's a longbow or a compound, whatever, it's a mechanical thing. So if you do what is required on your end to draw that string back, aim, release, then what must happen is that the arrow, the projectile, is going to end up exactly where it was intended, right? There's no magic that occurs. It's just physics. So it's 100% going to happen. You have to know that in your heart, that if I do my part of it, then there's no voodoo force that's going to come in and stop this from working out. It's going to be okay.
Absolutely. One of the most impactful things Joel Turner said to me when I was out there training with him was, he said, "What are you going to do before you take your shot?" And of course, this. Yeah. And then eventually he's like, "Make the decision. Make the decision that you're going to shoot a perfect shot. Tell yourself, I am going to shoot a perfect shot." And I think the power in making a decision gives you the power of being in control. Like, yeah. I'm going to be in control of that shot because I've already made the decision that that's going to be a good shot. I think that resonated with me more than anything.
I treat decisiveness like a hobby. I try to make decisions as quickly as I possibly can just for the sport of it.
Yeah, it's good. Good thing to practice.
Of course. And a lot of decisions that we really labor over are meaningless. They're meaningless.
Yeah.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah. I mean, there's something to be
watch
said.
Watch somebody go through a menu. Yeah. Watch somebody go through a menu at a restaurant and they will just struggle. It looks like they're fighting for their life. You can't go wrong. These are professional cooks. You pick this place because it's good. Whatever you get's going to be fine. And they will struggle. And the, you know, waiter's going to come back over and be like, "Made a decision yet?" I'm like, "No, we need a little more time." "No, you don't. You don't. Just make a decision, you know, start with that and start with it and build off of that in every aspect of your life. And then pretty soon it'll be fun just to see how fast you can make decisions. And as you develop that as a skill, you'll realize, okay, I made a decision, but it looks like it was the wrong one. So I'm going to make another decision, and then I'm going to make another decision, and I'm going to make these corrections really fast." There was a fighter pilot, and I think I can't even remember. His name was Lieutenant Colonel Boyd, and he came up with this thing called the OODA loop. Have I talked with you about this before?
Oh, no, but I've heard about this.
Okay, OODA, observe, orient, decide, and act. This is the universal decision-making cycle, and all of us do it. So we observe the situation, we orient on this situation based off of a huge number of factors, you know, our life experience, our genetics, lots of things go into the orientation portion of this. Then we make a decision, and then we act on that decision. And then by that action, we've altered the situation, right? So now we need to start over again. And that's why it's a loop. It's a process. Within military stuff, if you can go through that loop faster than your enemy, then you win the day. Because a lot of people will get in a situation where they don't make it through the orientation phase. And then they get to the point where they're not even able to accurately observe what the situation is. And that's panic. That's stationary panic where people can't move and make decisions. So knowing that everyone is going through this decision-making cycle kind of helps. So you observe, you orient, you decide, you act, you observe, keep doing it. And it's helpful for me to know that those are the steps that I'm going through. And that if I ever feel like I'm not making a decision, It's because I'm not going through those first two steps in a meaningful way.
Mm.
Man, that's huge in life, and that's huge in hunting. Like, Joel and I teach a hunting course every February, and I think that's where a lot of people mess up, is just the simple fact of just, like, observing it and then making a decision and understanding that no matter what the decision, it's not a bad one, because even if you failed, you're going to learn from it and gather more information and then just repeat that process, right? You're putting those puzzle pieces together. That's huge.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see how your military experience would transfer over into your hunting and, you know, for the mental aspect and being a huge help. Well, for sure. Just to help you in life in general.
Yeah. You know, you don't have to have gone through something like the military to be able to be good at something like this. Some of the most helpful books that I've read that I apply to hunting and apply to shooting are books about tennis or golf or chess. Start reading those books and then understand that it's a universal human experience, and you can take those as a metaphor and apply them to whatever problem you have, and you'll start doing really well. The nice thing about going after literature based on sports like that is that they have more participants. And because they have more participants, the people that rise to the top of that game are higher performers, just statistically speaking. So if I take something like tennis that's played all over the world and has lots of money behind it and lots of incentive to achieve at higher levels, and then you find the struggles that the top 10th of a percent of professional tennis players are dealing with, and see what they've learned about dealing with those struggles, now I can apply those to hunting and shooting and fishing, whatever I've got going on in my world, and I can steal from that larger body of work and, you know, those great minds and great athletes.
Mm. Yeah, that's funny. I've also read a couple of books which are completely unrelated to anything I'm passionate about, but there's just these takeaways that you can apply 100%, 100%. You know, the fact we're kind of on elk hunting, and we're sort of on failures. What have been, specifically for archery, what have been the biggest hurdles that have taken you the longest to overcome in your journey as an archery elk hunter?
Tempo.
Mm.
Learning when to wait and when to push, when to run, when to sneak. I think tempo is the mastery level of the game, and it's constantly changing. It changes by the minute. So you can't just come into the season with a plan and be like, this is how I'm going to live my life this year. It's different every day, and guiding every day of the season this year, I, you know, really got to see it. And I've always hunted the whole season, but I usually took some days off. But this year I really got to see it, where it's like, hey, you know, this is working now. Let's try it again tomorrow morning. No, way off, not even close. So that gets back into that observe, orient, decide, act thing. So learning tempo and getting a feel for it and a feel for how to manage the pace of the hunt, I think is one of the biggest hurdles for me. And then, you know, I think calling is something that I'm always evolving with as well, because you learn more about it. It truly is a language, and I didn't believe that for a long time. Joel Turner and I actually had an argument about this, gosh, back in like 2016, you know, we talked about it, and he was going to be guiding in a unit that was in a similar area to where I had hunted a lot and where I was guiding. And he believed strongly in a lot of the same dogma that he pushes now, where bulls are saying specific things and cows are saying specific Correct. Things. And I was like, man, they're not that complex. They're more simple than that. At this stage of my life, not only do I believe that the sounds that they're making are words. I think that they possess a degree of emotion, but furthermore, individuality. So if you, Joel, called me on the phone and I didn't have caller ID, I would know it was you within the first couple words.
Yeah.
I would know that with all of my friends. Right. And we, you and I don't get to talk that much, you know, half a dozen times a year, maybe more, maybe less. Those elk live with each other. So if I show up and make a sound and I'm not an elk, an individual that's familiar to them, I need to consider that. And I need to understand that I'm showing up and entering this conversation as a stranger, and that elk are going to have a similar reaction to that as the three of us would if suddenly a fourth voice showed up on this podcast.
James, I love this because I preach to Joel about this all the time. Whenever we come into an area that we haven't been to and we're trying to locate some animals, and I've told Joel so many times, I'm like, we're the new guy. And when we bugle, nobody knows us. So we have to be like, we can't just go in there a lot of times just raking shop unless it's just that situation, right? Like, we have to go in there being a lover before a fighter. And I learned a lot of that through the Elk Bros. And it's really true. Even whenever you go in and announce yourself as a cow, like, other cows are very catty, like women are, right? You go into a bar with a bunch of single women and there's one single dude in there, then they're going to end up being a little catty towards each other whenever the new girl, hot girl comes walking in, right? It's the same way with like elk. If somebody comes busting into your bedroom and that you don't realize their voice or know who they are, then it throws off everything. So the approach in elk hunting, in calling specifically and understanding like what you're saying, is so huge. And I think that's where a lot of people kind of go astray, because they immediately get a response, and that response might be just like, hey, there's elk over here, but who are you, kind of deal, you know? And they immediately go with some response that has nothing to do with, hey, I'm the new kid on the block and I just want to meet everybody, straight to, hey, we need an arm wrestle and fight.
Yeah.
It truly is another language. Like, it's just something that you could spend a lifetime trying to perfect and not perfect it. But I think from my limited experience, I agree with you 100%, James. I think the biggest thing is maybe not so much about how you call, it's when to do it. It's the timing of it, to the tempo. That's what. So when you say tempo, you're referring to the calling aspect too.
Oh yeah. Well, it's everything on timing, like when to move, when to sit still, when to talk, when to be quiet. All of that. I put all of that under the category of tempo.
Mm. And so do you prefer to call elk? Or do you prefer to kind of keep your location unknown, and would you prefer to sneak in on them without them knowing of your location? What's your general, I know it's a general question, but how would you, if you could choose, how would you approach an elk hunt in that regard?
I enjoy calling. I think it's exciting. It's one of the things that makes elk the best hunt in the world. And it is. It really is the best hunt in the world. And that interaction, that social interaction that you get to have with elk is incredibly special. So while it might not always be the best tactic, and it certainly is not always the best tactic, it's very fun. And it is what makes archery elk hunting really special, is the time of year that you get to do it and the way you interact with the animals. I will say that My personal favorite elk hunt happens in October. So I'll guide all of archery season. We're going after big bulls. We're having a good time. We're trying to chase down the dreams and desires of the people who hunt with me. And then I get to take a little bit of time off, maybe go do a couple buck hunts, something that's low key. I can celebrate how light a white-tailed deer is. You know, I can just pick it up and throw it around. And then I get to go back out to the elk woods, and I typically donate 4 to 6 hunts to veterans every year, and we hunt for cow elk with rifles. But I still call, and I call to locate the herds, and I call in a way that I feel like can agitate them in a way that they'll continue being vocal. And then we stalk them like we would if we're hunting in Africa, except with the addition of sounds. And some, you know, some African animals make sounds as they're going places. Buffalo do a little bit and other things, sure. But to follow an elk herd, that's talking as they go and sneak in on them and then get, you know, typically less than 80 yards away and shoot them with rifles. Oh, it's good. It's so good. And I get to shop the herd, you know, I can pick out like a 2-year-old cow and, you know, she's dead instantly and the meat is perfect.
Oh,
I love it. I love everything about that hunt.
There is just something great. There's just something great about a good rifle hunt. I did the struggle bus game in Oklahoma for a week or so, and then immediately went and got invited to a place and took a rifle and was just made a harvest my first hour and a half. And I was like, there's just something awesome about that because I struggled so much before, and then to come out here with a rifle and just boom, you know, just something awesome about, something real American about it too. I love it.
God, I just love it all, man.
Yeah.
I love, people say to me like, when I think of the word hunting, it doesn't really involve anything with the killing side of it.
Yeah.
That it's that primal internal engine to get out there and find these animals in their landscape and get eyeball close. That is hunting.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that. To be able to play the chess game where you basically come out on top when you get within their safety bubble. You're in their safety bubble. They sure as heck don't know you're in there. They don't want you there. And if they knew you were there, they'd be gone. But you outsmarted them. That right there is what, there's not too many things that make me feel as alive as that.
Yeah.
It's part of who we are. It's what we are as a species. I do want to talk about the killing aspect of it though a little bit if you'll allow me to.
Please.
I would love to. Can I start you off with a question on that?
Please do.
How do you feel when you kill an animal? And I don't mean hey dude, don't you feel bad cuz you killed that animal? No, I'm meaning like seriously introspectively, like telling us what emotional roller coaster ride, if there are any, what happens in James Nash's body?
I feel amazing. I really love that portion of it. And there's a lot of pressure on hunters to lie about that. And well, it's not like that every time. There's sometimes I've had a cocktail of very mixed emotions, and that's okay too. Most of the time I feel like, heck yeah. I'm so stoked. I just feel amazing. And I think that most people do. And if they don't feel purely good, it's usually the thing that is complicating that feeling is some cognitive doubt that they shouldn't be feeling good about it. Just like a societal pressure or something like that. But for the evolution of our species, if you killed an animal that you're hunting for food, that means that you and your family and the people that are closest to you get to survive. It is supposed to feel good. And you can feel gratitude and you can feel emotion. And that emotion can get expressed in all kinds of crazy ways where you're laughing and crying and shaking. But the reality is, It does feel good for that portion where that animal dies. And, you know, good is a weird word that we use for all kinds of things. But generally, for me, I feel great when I kill an animal. And it's because I think it's programmed into us that what that means is survival.
And to your point, I am 100% certain that the only people that would disagree are the people that have never actually been in a feast or famine type of situation. Because I can tell you from experience, when you are hungry, I mean, like your stomach feels like it's touching your spine.
Yeah.
Like when you are that hungry, I don't care who you are, you will eat whatever you can. And so if you're in that kind of position, that kind of mindset, and you kill a game animal that's going to feed you for months, if you don't feel happy in this, you're not human.
Yeah.
Or you've never been a part of that community of the kill, you know, and taking part of that harvest and what happens after that, right? Because they're blind to the killing that happens for them in these giant, you know, situations, as far as like the, you know, the food industry and stuff like that goes. I didn't mean to interrupt you, James.
Yeah. Well, I'm agreeing with you. We're all killers. It doesn't matter what it is that you consume. Animals are dying so that you can eat, for every single one of us. And we're all complicit in that. And that's part of how it works. But the death portion of it is kind of a sentimental artifact for us. Because if we really think about it, the reality is energy cannot be created or destroyed.
Correct.
We're all carbon-based life forms. And that carbon is just transitioning from one thing to the next. So the death aspect of it really isn't founded in chemistry or physics. It comes from our own emotions and probably ultimately from our own struggles with mortality.
Yeah.
Yes. There's man, there's so many things I want to say about that. It's just sort of like which direction to go.
So I want to bring something up, Joel, just because, James, this is one of the first clips that I saw of you of with the deer leg that you had been hanging for long periods of time. Dude, that's one of my favorite. I shared that with so many people before I knew that you and Joel were even friends. And then that's what blew my mind. I was like, I've got to dig into this because I think a lot of people get weirded out with their meat being hung long term.
Not being in a refrigerator.
Yeah, or not being in a refrigerator, exactly. And you hung this meat out, and you do it, I guess, periodically and make all kind of different stuff. And man, that's so awesome. And do you think somebody like me down here in Texas could hang up a ham over the summer and cure that sucker?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here's what you need to do, because I don't know a lot about your climate.
Okay.
But what you can do is you can go talk to people who have knowledge of how natives preserved meat in your area and then do that. I imagine that in your climate, they cut it into thin strips and hung it up and made something like biltong. But just do whatever worked for natives in your environment, and it's still going to work. Joel and I have talked about this before.
Yeah.
Some of the meat that you'll see people eat in Africa and other countries doesn't look good, doesn't look healthy. And it really
green color to it.
It goes against what we think is okay. But I believe that we evolved with those bacteria and that they're important for us to be able to function well. And there's so much research that is out now about how important the microbiome of our gut is and throughout our body. I had somebody on my show years ago now talking specifically about this, and all of the bacteria and viruses that are in our body, all of those organisms are older than humans are by a lot. Okay. So, you know, we're just a host, you know, I'm a community of microorganisms, And the microorganisms that occur in meat are healthy for us. You see somebody take a bite of this long dry aged stuff, and they'll have some doubts going into it. You know, they're like, "What? Why is the outside of it white? Yeah. Was there mold on this?" Like, yeah, there was mold on it. And then they take a bite of it and they smile universally. Everybody, after they take a bite of it and the flavors of that hit their palate, they have a reaction of happiness to it. And how interesting is that?
Yeah.
And if I give them a fresh piece of meat, they might enjoy it, but they don't have that reaction. And wow. I find that fascinating.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. Well,
if you look at our history, I mean, from the Native Americans to the Native Africans, all the indigenous, they had to preserve meat in a very similar way. And most of the natives that were living with severe seasonal changes, that dried, preserved meat was what got them through the hardest times. That was their lifeline. And I do feel like that's just still, it still rings genetically in us. When we eat some dried, you know, jerky, biltong, it probably deep inside of us, there's just like a small subconscious memory of, this is what kept me alive once upon a time.
Yeah, you can think of it in terms of currency as well. So if somebody's living paycheck to paycheck, that's like somebody who's consuming only fresh food. And then if that person doesn't get paid and it happens again, they go through the next pay period, they're panicking. They're in a bad place. But the person that saves some money, they're like, I'm all right. I can weather this out. It's the same way with food, but more so, right? Because food came first. Like, meat is older than money by a lot. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's one way for people to think about it in their own lives a little bit. Like, if you didn't have ready access to fresh food anytime that you wanted it, in what kind of condition would you be? And how long could you actually survive if that wasn't replenished? We see it here. You know, we are 76 miles from the interstate. So when it snows and the gacked out Russian truckers pile it up on the interstate and they shut the whole thing down, our grocery store is empty in 36 hours. And a lot of people are really panicked about that. But the people that, you know, put up some meat in the fall and did some canning and, you know, preserved some vegetables, things like that, they're like, whatever, you know, go in 2 or 3 weeks or 3 months, like, it's going to be fine. So that comes back into that self-sufficiency and that resilience thing that we're talking about earlier.
Absolutely.
Worst case scenario, you have some fun picking up a new skill.
Yeah.
Right?
And who doesn't?
Correct. There's really no negatives.
Yeah. And who doesn't?
There's
like,
no reason not to do this.
Like, I swear to you, you could put a freaking a piece of deer jerky in front of a vegan and they will take it from you. For real. I've never seen anybody that turns down any deer jerky.
Yeah. Oh man, that's my favorite way to do deer, especially the mule deer, man. A lot of jerky.
Yeah.
Okay. So, man, I want to switch gears, but before we do, could you take us through your process, sort of a brief process of how you go from butchering to eating that aged meat?
Yeah.
Just for the listeners.
Sure. So the one that we're talking about was a white-tailed doe hind quarter. It might've been a buck. I can't remember. Doesn't matter. It was a hind quarter. It was bone in. And what I did is I rubbed it down with kosher salt and then layered the salt on as thick as I could. And I put it inside a game bag. I use Argali game bags, but there's lots of good game bags out there. You want something that's going to be breathable. You want that moisture to be able to come out of it. And I hung it up in the breezeway of my shop. So it's got open air on it, 360 degrees, but it had a roof over it. So the birds and the bugs can't get to it, but everything else can, right? And I left it there for 10 days. Pulled it down. I took a stiff bristle brush and I brushed all the salt off of it. And then I hung it back up. This was in October. And then in April, the following year, I was coming back from fishing. It was the first like 60 something degree day, 70 degree day. I thought, well, I'll go check it out. And I went and grabbed it and it was It was white like a piece of driftwood, and I cut into it, and the meat was cherry red, and I ate it, and it was fantastic. That was the first time that I'd aged something that long before, really without any supervision. There's all kinds of dry agers and various devices that you can get to try to do this if you live in a really warm climate. But the bottom line is you want to put that salt on there, and you can experiment with other seasonings like garlic and pepper, thyme, whatever you want. And what you're really trying to do is make an acidic surface on the outside of the meat, draw moisture out of it, and then allow the remaining moisture to go out of it really slowly. You only want to do this with whole mussels. If it's something that is cut or ground up, then you have the potential to introduce some harmful bacteria that are anaerobic to those environments. And those are the times where you're going to need something like nitrites, nitrates, etc., to make it a hostile environment for those harmful bacteria to grow in. And that's why when you make sausage, you're going to use prog powder and things like that just to make it safe. But if it's a whole mussel, then you can get away with dry aging it for a long time. And it's a pretty cool experience.
And thank you for explaining that. The reason I wanted you to explain that is because it's so ridiculously simple. You didn't use any machinery or anything. No. You just hung it up in the breeze and it cured by itself. And that's,
I used a knife and salt and the weather and a game bag. Like it's not hard. And lots of people, like, you know, that was a really popular video. Lots of people have tried this, which is so rewarding for me to see. And I get messages from people all the time that they're showing me how their hindquarters hanging and drying out. And then, you know, they're cutting into it and serving it with some fancy cheddar to their family at a party. And they just love it. You know, I think that's so cool.
That is so cool.
It's like a novelty, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I totally agree with the whole gut biome thing. I mean, when I'm with the Hadza, I purposefully will do as they do, which is butcher the animal, blood still on the hands. The lack of water in that dry, arid environment does not give them the luxury to wash their hands off after butchering an animal and then eating it. So they're literally using the dry, bloody crusted hands that they just butchered the animal with to then eat the animal. And I think that mixture of the sort of the uncooked organisms versus then, of course, the cooked, because they cook all their meat, I think that combination is just so important for us. It's so important. We are like wild animals in that aspect. We just have to retrain ourselves to change from the domesticated beings that we are back to more of the wild beings that we once were. But we used to be able to tolerate all these things. We had to. We wouldn't be here if we couldn't do that.
Yeah. So electricity and refrigeration are new. So yeah. they're brand new.
Exactly.
Brand
new,
if you think about it. So no, there's lots of ways to do it. And smoke and the sun and salt are really the fundamental tools for preserving meat. I eat a ton of stuff raw. When I'm butchering stuff for my clients or for myself, I am eating as I go. And I really enjoy that. And everybody that I've offered that raw meat to, they really like it too. So I think that there's something that's fundamentally satisfying about eating raw meat while you're cutting your animal up as well.
Agreed. Hey, so James, I have to ask, I want to be able to respect your time. Are you still good and available for us to keep going?
I've got all night, buddy.
Perfect. Okay. I really want to get onto this topic. You have inspired me to walk down the path of predator hunting.
Yes.
At this point, yes, it's because of you, 100%. I never in my life thought or even entertained or wanted to hunt any predator. But listening to you, the way you talk about it, and to sort of kind of paraphrase, the responsibility that we have as hunters to take some of these predators off the landscape really motivated me to do it. And last year was my first season bear hunting, unsuccessful, but I had a really close stalk, decided not to shoot because he was just a young black bear. But I found the bear hunting extremely challenging. This could go so many ways. If we have time, I'd like to delve into wolves, but I'd really like to start with bears. I'd love to ask you two things. First of all, why is it responsible, or why would you advocate for any hunter to hunt black bears?
It's a great question.
And number two, which I'll let you get back to it at your own pace. If you could, for guys like me and Cole hasn't hunted black bears either, we're brand new to it. If you could give us the basic 101 do's and don'ts of bear hunting, that would be appreciated immensely.
Okay. Well, I love bears. They're probably my favorite wild animal. I love watching them. The biology of bears is something that is so underrated and so fascinating. And I'll tell you something that I learned about them this year that is just completely blowing my mind. All right. Let me talk about bears for a second, and then we'll talk about hunting bears a little bit more. All right. So the life cycle, like the year of a bear, we're looking at like November, late October, bears going towards their dens. They don't hibernate, but they do go into torpor. So their metabolism is going to drop way down. Their heart rate shuts down. They don't urinate. They don't defecate. A lot of the bears I've learned in Northeast Oregon will actually den in the tops of broken trees. And sometimes that's 100 feet or more off the ground. So they're just up there like in a stove.
Exposed? Just exposed?
Sometimes exposed, but they like big white fur that have the top broken off and then new growth coming out of it that protects them from snow a little bit. Some of them dig holes in hillsides, into rocks, hollow logs. They'll den lots of places, but they go into that den and they're really slowing all of their operating system down. Now, they come out of those dens periodically all winter long, stretch their legs, whatever, go back in. But they're not eating, they're not drinking water, not eating snow, none of that. So the sows at the end of January are going to have their cubs if they're pregnant. She is going to produce milk for her cubs that are born at about the size of a can of pop, right? Like little tiny things. She's going to produce milk for them, liquid fatty milk from her own fat, and stay in the den with them. Like this is a miracle unto itself. She's producing milk without drinking water. And then as they come out of the dens in the springtime, April, May timeframe, then she can start drinking water, eating grass, things like that to replenish all those stores. Now, end of May, early June is breeding season for bears. And it had always bothered me that for a big animal that's breeding in June, why are they having such a small cub so many months later in February, right? This didn't make any sense to me. The gestation is long enough to have something that's much more developed than this little tiny hairless rat looking thing. So what happens is in October, if she's getting 3,000 calories a day, 30,000 calories a day, and her body condition is good, then that, I think it's called a blastocyst, the sperm and the egg have just been floating around in her uterus all summer and fall long. If she's in good body condition, then it will attach to the uterine wall and she'll start developing those cubs. And she can have cubs from multiple boars at the same time if she gets bred by multiple boars. But if she doesn't have good body condition, then she can self-abort with zero stress whatsoever. So in the fall, when she needs to be focusing on putting on as much food as possible and as much weight as possible, that's usually with other animals, that's when they're also breeding. But the bear doesn't do that because it needs to be focusing on food. And if it doesn't have enough food, then it doesn't allow itself to you know, go to term with that pregnancy. That is so incredibly adaptive and amazing. It just blows my mind. But there's all kinds of cool things about bears like that.
That is mind blowing and quite polar opposite to a lot of the other big game animals in North.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Right. So if you look at elk, they're out there running around like a bunch of teenagers losing all their body weight. A bull can lose a couple hundred pounds in September, and then he's in terrible condition going into the winter.
It's not the smartest tactic.
Yeah. It's nuts. But the bear is just so much smarter, just biologically smarter. And then if you're going to talk about their actual intelligence, they're extremely intelligent and so adaptive. Bears can live everywhere that people do, right? Except for Antarctica, and we only barely live there, only kind of for science. So every other place in the world that there's people, there's bears.
It's so cool. And they do pretty much mimic the same. They have a very similar digestive system to human beings, from what I understand. I mean, obviously, they're omnivores, but they're pretty much opportunists. They will eat whatever they can.
Absolutely. And they'll go to where that food is. So they'll travel a lot to find the ideal food for them for that time of year. But why hunt bears? That's a really good question. Why would I go out and spend so much of my year hunting an animal that I love so much? One is to interact with them and to be able to observe them and to learn about them. Another is that it is a sustainable thing. We can hunt bears every year, and we have. Throughout all of human history, humans have hunted bears, and we continue to. The things that we get from bears are really good things. So that bear hide is great for making all kinds of materials, either from the leather or from the fur. Bear hide has always been something that's been really important. Bear fat is a great treatment for leather. It's wonderful in pastries. You can use it to make chapstick. Like, bear fat is awesome. And you can render that down, and there's a lot of it on a bear, especially in the fall.
That was quite a big commodity to the pioneers that started heading out west, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. And to the natives who are already here.
Yep.
And then in addition to that, you get some really nutrient dense meat. Now, we've got to be careful in how we consume bear meat, because some bears carry trichinosis. Now, I've been getting into this a little bit, and I'm trying to find the right person to go on my podcast to talk about it. But it looks like it's only around 3% of bears in the lower 48 actually carry trich. So it's a much smaller percentage than what we think. Mm. And what I'd like to get to is the point where we can test it to learn whether an individual bear has trichinosis or not. So if your bear doesn't, then you can cook it rare. Mm. But as it is, let's just go ahead and safety up and assume that they are carrying trichinosis, and we're going to cook that, cook it well done. Bear lends itself to every French beef recipe that you can find. And the French are good at food. Okay. So find yourself a French beef recipe that is braised and cooked over a long period of time, and substitute beef for bear, and you're going to have a meal that will blow people's minds. It is just awesome. It also makes really good sausage. Mix it with some pork. Oh, wonderful sausage. You can give away. People sausage, love it.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, another thing that you get from bears, and I'm looking up here on my shelf, is the skull. I love skulls, and it is such a gateway to a memory and to excitement and imagination about that animal and its life and the place that it lived and the hunt that you got to experience in that small portion of its life that you got to share with it before, you know, you became part bear yourself by eating it. Like, it's all great. Now, from an ecological standpoint, we're at a place in a lot of the Intermountain West where we have a rising population of predators and a falling population of prey. So in Oregon specifically, we have a huge population of mountain lions. We have a growing population of wolves. We have a large, healthy population of black bears. Some places in Oregon, we have an unhealthy population of black bears because there's too many of them. So something that we can do as hunters is we can go out in the springtime or in early fall, and we can hunt bears. And then you can also hunt elk. If you're only hunting prey animals, then you are increasing the deficit of that prey species much more so than if you also hunt one of the animals that is causing that deficit. So if I kill a bear in the springtime, which is probably going to eat 30 or 40 elk calves and fawns in just about a month period when those animals are really young, and then I've created a bunch of space for deer and elk to be able to grow within their ecosystem, to grow within that niche. And then when I kill an elk that fall, I can consider that one of the 30 that gets to live because I killed a bear this spring.
Hmm.
You know? So it's just a way of managing the balance of the ecosystem. And when I say balance, I'm talking about more so along the lines of like balancing your checkbook.
I just love your, how you present that. I love the fact that you are willing to present it. And this is the kind of conversation that needs to be had more, where general public, their ears need to fall onto conversations like this. They need to understand. I was absolutely, after hearing you say that on one of your podcasts, was absolutely, it changed my entire thought and about hunting predators, to where I felt responsible to engage in predator hunting because of my love. Not that I don't love bears. I love all animals, all of them. I love them ever since I was a kid. But I do want to be able to hunt elk and deer forever. And I want my son to be able to hunt them forever. And if it means that I'm going to help by hunting predators to achieve that, I'm going to do it.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an example. So the bear tag I drew this spring is for a unit that for the past 3 years has had calf elk recruitment that is single digits.
Mm.
Now, for an elk population to maintain its population, we need 12 to 17 calves per 100 cows to survive through the winter. If we don't have that, then the population decreases. And as it decreases and it becomes unhealthy, that's the point where predation can become additive instead of compensatory. Additive means that now it's an unhealthy population of prey, so the pressure from those predators is going to cause that cascade in the prey population. So it's been single digits for several years. If I can go in there and kill a bear, that really helps. That really helps. That's an extra 30 calves that gets to live. So if more people can go out there and be successful on bears, then that can really, really help that population of elk come back. It gives them a chance. There's nothing I can do with wolves right now. And, you know, while I hunt cougars, it's very difficult and I'm rarely successful. Same thing with coyotes. If you're able to go out and hunt coyotes a little bit, that's going to help your deer population.
Sure. Yeah.
But all of it helps. Now, as far as tactics go, we'll break it down kind of into three categories. Spring bear, most underrated hunt in North America. By far, you get every aspect of every expensive hunt that there is. Like if you take a sheep hunt, an elk hunt, a deer hunt, you can have everything that those hunts have to offer, but in a spring bear hunt. That's the glassing, the hiking, the camping, the being in a crazy remote area, getting to interact with cool animals. Usually the sheep and elk and everything are right there where you're bear hunting too. So the only thing that changes is which animal you're actually pursuing at the time. So it's a great time of year. It's a great opportunity. In the springtime, I am looking at vegetation. I want to find that grass that is about 500 to 800 feet below the snow line, the stuff that's really green, the little tubers that are coming up. And that's what I'm going to focus on, especially early
season. That new growth that's coming up in the moist soil just below the snow line.
Yep,
full of nutrients.
As we progress into the season, I focus on the areas where arrowleaf balsam root is growing.
And oh, gotcha.
Bears really like to dig those roots up. They'll eat the petals off the flowers. And then the bottom of the stem, I think all of us at some point have pulled apart a piece of grass and eaten that little white part that's kind of sweet at the bottom of it.
The heart,
Bears are really focusing on that, on arrowleaf balsam root. And then as you get into the end of May, you should go to the elk and delt calving grounds and the places where mule deer and whitetail are having their fawns. If you don't know where those are, go find your local wildlife biologist and ask them where elk are calving. And then you can use predator sounds like a calf in distress to call bears in. One of the best things about doing that is that the only bears you're going to be interacting with are the bears that are killing elk, right? Mm. So you're being very selective about how you're going about removing those bears from the ecosystem.
Is that one of your preferred tactics? Are you doing that every spring? No.
So I don't get a tag every year, but when I do, I'm going up a little bit earlier, and I really like to glass. I'll spend all day in my glass watching hillsides and watching places where I think bears might be grazing and moving in and out of, and then I get as close to them as possible and take a shot.
Yeah. Could you talk, because this is the one thing about bears that's quite unlike any other animal I've hunted, is their time of activity. They seem to be very unpredictable as to when they're going to become active. Could you speak to that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So the time of day does not matter in the springtime. You might see a little bit of activity right at last light. But generally speaking, you can see a bear any time of day in the spring. And it's because they've got this massive calorie deficit from not getting to eat all winter long. So they're really trying to put on as many calories as possible. And there's not a lot of caloric value in the grass that they're eating. So something that you need to consider is that their digestive system is a little bit jacked up from not eating all winter long. So they can't even eat meat for a while after they get out of their den. So they're really going to focus on those fibrous materials to get their digestive system going again, and then they can start looking at eating meat.
Have you hunted? I'm sure you've hunted bears in the fall, but like the difference between hunting them in the spring and the fall.
Yeah. So let's say that spring, the first tactic is to find the vegetation that I think they're going to be consuming, get in that area, and observe it from long distances with optics. And also position myself in a way that I can get within shooting distance of an animal if I detect it in that area. Okay. It doesn't do you any good to glass something that you can't get to.
Sure. Right. Good point. Yeah.
So that's springtime. In the fall, bears love, they really love orchards. We think of bears in berry patches all the time, but when berries are on, they're dispersed all over the place. So you can't just like hang out in a huckleberry patch and hope for the best. That's not a very good tactic. I've personally never seen a bear eat a huckleberry. And I've watched them walk through huckleberry patches before, but it takes gallons of huckleberries to equal, you know, a handful of calories. So this isn't really a good use of their time. I think that they do it because it's sweet and tastes good, but anyways, berry patches.
I'm just so happy to hear you say that. You know, because
I was like, we're stirring shit up right here.
I just love how people will be like, oh, it's easy. Just find the food. You'll find the bears. Well, I don't know how many berry patches I've walked past and I've found no bear sign. And I'm a good tracker. I've found no bear sign. And of course, sometimes I have, but it's not as simple as find fresh berries and you're going to find bears.
Yeah. No, that's some cartoon stuff that I think has messed people up there, but orchards are the real deal. Now, if you can find places where there used to be homesteads, and there's lots of them out on national forest, find the places that used to have homesteads, and there's probably still fruit trees there. And if there's fruit trees there, there are bears there. So the thing about hunting them in the fall is they're much more nocturnal. So that's going to be a place where you're going to want to get, you know, I really encourage people to hunt bears with rifles as much as possible. They're especially in the fall. They're an awful animal to shoot with a bow. They've got so much fat. It plugs up holes really quickly. They don't bleed very well. and they're a big, you know, blobby object as it is. So it's hard. It's harder to pick out a good spot to hit them. And people also panic when they're close to a bear. So I encourage you to get, you know, 300 yards or so away from that orchard and make yourself a little home and just live there for as long as it takes. And a bear is going to show up and you're going to get an opportunity. And bears that are living in orchards taste so good. So good. Like if I can find bears that are eating pears and apples, oh, that is some legitimately good wild game meat.
Now, isn't that the truth that they taste like what they eat? I mean, we've hunted those pecan-fed pigs in Texas, like myself and Cole, and oh my God, the meat is, the fat tastes like pecans. Incredible.
It does. So in cattle, it takes about 3 months when you change their food to see it show up as a really different taste as far as your palate's concerned. With bears, I think it happens quite a bit faster.
Yeah. Oh, gotcha. Such awesome information. The fall, the bears are going to, would I be correct in saying that they're going to be a little more active in the late afternoon, evening than in the morning time?
It's going to be a first thing at morning and last thing in the evening thing. Yeah. So if you can't find an orchard, other great places are creek bottoms to check out. There's a tree called the hawthorn in eastern Oregon that grows along all of our low elevation creeks, and bears do eat those hawthorn berries really well. You'll know instantly if there's bears that are there that are doing it, because there's going to be bear crap all over the road or all over the trail. And if that's the case, again, just back out and know that that's a travel corridor. Know that there's been bears that have been coming through there. That's a good tactic in August in Oregon. And I know there's people listening to this show all over the place. In Oregon, a bear tag costs $16.50 for residents and non-residents. And you can get two bear tags in the fall. Starts August 1st and goes through either the beginning of December or the end of the year. It's a tremendous opportunity. And if you want to talk about a budget hunt that's high adventure, that is good for the ecosystem, that is good for you, you should really consider bear hunting.
There we go, Cole.
I'm sold 100%. How about on the spring bear, is that all draw for non-resident?
It's all draw for everyone in the springtime.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to bounce over to Idaho, Joel. I was just sitting here thinking about that orchard where we camped in Idaho. Remember the all the plums right there? There were bears coming up our camp nightly.
They killed that bear. Like what? The fourth day of the hunt, they killed that bear. Yeah, the young black bear.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're in there.
Yeah, they're in there. But bear hunting is
exciting animal hunt.
Bear hunting is definitely in my future. I can just see my dream is to fly out somewhere, rent a car, and then just bomb out with my backpack and rifle and spend 7 days just looking at a green patch and, you know, hopefully come across a bear. That sounds a lot easier than it is.
The thing that just to kind of pay even more tribute to bears. So I've only stalked two bears in my life. Like I said, last year was my first time hunting them. The first stalk at 25 yards downwind. Now this is bow hunting, right? So trad bow. 25 yards downwind, it stopped and it put its nose up and it hoofed and it ran to a high point, turned around, immediately pinpointed me, and it kept on going. This is when I say downwind, I was downwind. So I was blown away because the body language that it displayed was clearly it smelled me.
Yeah.
And that was this bear upwind. So I immediately had this respect for their nose and just how incredible it is.
Yeah.
So that is definitely something I consider. When you say you'd recommend hunting with a rifle, obviously to have an ethical harvest, but also just because the chances of getting busted when you're trying to get 25 yards from that animal, I think, are so high when they've got a nose on them like that. So I think, yeah, I think a rifle, or, you know, at least a muzzle loader probably would be a better option than the bow.
Their sense of smell is orders of magnitude higher than that of a bloodhound. It's really incredible. I've seen them smell people from over a mile away. And it happened to me a couple years ago on a spring bear hunt. I'd spotted a bear way up in the cliffs. I'd made this epic climb to an adjacent ridge. I'd snuggled in and I could just see his ears and part of his side, and he was sleeping in this brush. And I was like, well, you know, enjoy your nap and I'll see you when you wake up. I've got all the time in the world. You don't. And suddenly his head shot up and he took off, and there is no earthly way that he could have smelled me. And about 20 minutes later, a group of guys came up this canyon who were turkey hunting. And my best guess is that they were over a mile away when he smelled them.
Wow.
On the other side of that, I killed a bear in North Carolina in December, and I was sitting in a tree stand in a jungly swamp, nasty, thorny place. And this bear, I could hear coming behind me. I could hear him going. And he came up behind a little tiny pine tree about the size of a coffee can. I'm a big guy. And he scratched on this tree. And then he started pushing on it. And the tree was shaking, like, a lot. And he 100% knew that I was there. There's not a doubt in my mind. You know,
he was just screwing with you. Oh, that's hilarious.
And he walked around the front of this tree, and he hit the ladder with his shoulder and shook the whole tree stand. And I was like, enough of this, sir. And I shot that bear at like 12 feet with a rifle. And I was so spun up, dude. Oh, my goodness.
Oh.
But I'd been invited to come out there by this duck club that was, you know, having some bear problems, and they're nervous about these bears. It's like, this is the exact type of bear that these guys asked me to come out here to kill. Mm. And it was really cool. I think that the shot was still echoing through the woods when we started getting phone calls from people that wanted bear meat. And by the time I had him hung up and was skinning and butchering, we had a crowd of people just holding out bags, you know, ready for meat.
Looking for handouts.
It just warms my heart to be able to share meat with people. It's my favorite aspect of hunting.
Yeah. You know what, though? You're such a generous guy. I mean, I can see how, like, I mean, for you just to sit here and just share with us in such a captivating way, and being, I will say, you know, you're definitely, I would call you one of my mentors. You know, you've really given me a lot of advice with hunting elk, and a lot of it's been extremely helpful. Of course, a lot of it's come through your podcast too, but I thank you so much for your generosity. I think that, as hunters, this is something, well, I'll refrain that as a hunter, I strive to be the same. I strive to be generous with information, because I know that we all don't want to have more hunters crowding the woods, but at the same time, we do need more hunters, because we want to be able to continue hunting. And for that, we do need to have hunters. So I strive to have that same sort of generosity to others. So thank you for that.
Well, Joel, I admire you so much. And I have, since I first saw you on television and talked with you afterwards, and, you know, I really value our friendship, and I come to you for advice as well. And I genuinely respect your take on life. And I think people need to pay attention to the things that you and Cole are saying, because you're asking good questions and you're living it out. You're doing the thing and you're helping people along the way. And that's a really special thing, because, you know, when I grew up, that didn't exist. Even my family, I could ask them questions about hunting, and they just tell me to go figure it out. And yes, that's a slow road with a lot of unnecessary pain. And the stage that I'm at is that I can give people almost all the information I have and it doesn't affect my experience at all. Right.
Yep. Correct.
It doesn't threaten what I'm doing. And I do think that it's important to get new hunters. I think it's important for people that used to hunt to try it again. But more than anything, I think it's important for hunters to be honest about who they are, what they do, why they do it, and to talk about that with people who don't hunt and who aren't interested in it. Because increasingly, this stuff is going to show up on the ballots. And the more people that understand that this is something that's sustainable and important and ultimately good for wildlife, even though it's such a hard thing to say, look, I love this animal and I'm going to kill it. And that's the best thing for the species. Like that's so hard to explain, but we've got to keep trying to do it. Otherwise, the people who don't understand are going to say, well, no, that doesn't make sense. So let's get rid of you.
Yes. Well, first of all, I'm flattered that you have said that that you're enjoying yourself and that we've asking good questions because, you know, I've done several podcasts myself before starting my own one with Cole, and the one I did with you, hands down, your questions that you asked were fantastic. Like you have the natural ability. So I feel flattered that, you know, you would say that. Our agenda is definitely to help be that voice. We've got a lot to learn about game management, but there are the basics that, in my opinion, are not hard to understand for a hunter who's got his head in the right place. So we are the out there to do that. I mean, we started running this Intro to Hunting course in Texas, which is doing really well, purely to try and help people cut out those steep initial learning curves to where they can actually start to find some level of success sooner and without making a ton of mistakes before they do. And the feedback that we've had from that has just been very affirming, and it motivates us to keep doing that and also to keep sharing the information just like we are here on this podcast. And that's big part of our agenda. Just keep doing that. Let's get people excited about hunting. But like you say, let's be truthful. Hunting is hard. It's not easy. Let's talk about that, you know?
Well, I love you and I love Texas. And if you ever need a hand, let me know. Because
it's oh, dude.
Great to go
oh,
down
man.
There.
Yeah. We'd
Joel,
love to
yeah. That. I think James would be a great addition to our pre-course pig hunt. it'd be pretty man. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So much fun.
Yeah, we might have to line that up. We usually do it in about February. So I don't know how your weather looks up there, James, in February, but
February is a good time to not be here.
Yeah.
Good time to escape.
Well, man,
go ahead, Cole.
Yeah, we want to be respectful of your time. I can't tell you how excited I was to have you on the show. And just come and sit and BS with Joel and I, like after talking to you, man, I consider you to be a great friend and somebody I have so much more that I want to ask, and there's so much for us to talk about.
We're gonna have him back.
Oh yeah, for sure.
You're coming back, James.
Yeah. Down let's the do line. It again sometime.
Yeah.
Sure.
So
I like this.
Tell everybody where they can find you and all of your content and even your guiding. Like if you have opportunities available there as well, we'd love to share with everybody.
Thank you. I have no opportunities for guiding right now. My books are currently closed, which is a strange place to be in as an outfitter, but it's the reality. I'm happy to help people find a guide. I get no benefit from that, but I'm happy to help. You can find me at Six Ranch Outfitters on Instagram. It's the number 6. You can also follow the Six Ranch podcast, which is everywhere. But most importantly, folks, I just want you to give your support to these guys right now. And the best way to do that is to write them a review on whatever podcast platform you listen to this on, and then share it with somebody that you think might enjoy the show. Hmm. That's it. That's all you have to do. And it means so much, and it helps. It helps the community. It helps everybody, and helps wildlife. So just do that. Just give these guys your support right now in those two small ways. It'll take you seconds to do that.
Really appreciate that, man. Much love for you, James. Appreciate you. Look forward to eventually meeting you in person. I look forward to that day. At some point, it'll happen.
Next February, too, man. Texas Hog Hunt.
Good luck to you guys. Keep. Yeah.
Yeah. There we go.
I'm all about it. I'm all about it.
Sorry.
Yeah, we'll definitely be in touch about that. No doubt.
Okay. Well, good luck to you guys and keep working hard.
Thanks so much, y'all.
Have a great night.
Y'all, thank you so much for sticking through this podcast. We really appreciate your support. And if you guys haven't left us a review yet, please go to where you listen to us and leave us a review. We really would appreciate that. And y'all, if you want to leave us any comments, or if you want us to talk about a topic that you are interested in, or you think we would be great to help explain or teach a topic, please reach out to us at bushsurvivaltraining.com and give us an email there, and we would love to hear from you, and we'd love for your question to be a part of the show. So thank you so much, you guys, and until next time, we are going to be in the bush. Until next time, you guys, thank you so much. And this is it for In the Bush podcast with Cole and Joel. See y'all next Monday.